Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. Welcome to The Rest is History. We're on day 4 of our great marathon, the 12 Days of Christmas, or indeed in our case, the 13 Days of Christmas. Tom Holland's brilliant idea to force me
to ruin the week before Christmas.
Yeah, by recording endless podcasts about exciting moments that happened on this day over the festive season many years ago. So, Tom, do you have a jolly, light-hearted...
I do. It's the jolliest and the most light-hearted. It's the Massacre of the Innocents.
Right, so tell us about this.
Well, it probably didn't happen.
Okay, that's a good start.
And if it did happen, it probably didn't happen on this day. But today is Childermas, when the church commemorates the massacre of the innocent babies of Bethlehem, who were slaughtered by King Herod. And the story is, it's only told in the Gospel of St. Matthew, that the three wise men come from the east. They come to Herod. They say, we've seen a star. King of the Jews has been born. We want to go and pay our respects. Herod is kind of stressed out about this, but disguises it. Says, well, you need to go to Bethlehem then. And when you've discovered who this King of the Jews is, could you come back and tell me? Because I'd like to go and pay my respects as well. The three wise men go to Bethlehem. They discover Jesus. They give him the gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And then they're visited by an angel who says, "Don't go and tell Herod."
Yeah, big mistake.
So they go back home. Angel also appears to Joseph and says, "Scram, get out of here." And so Joseph and Mary and the baby Jesus head off to Egypt. Herod is so furious that he orders his men to slaughter all the newborn male babies in Jerusalem, and the carnage ensues. Now,
that's mad because he knows that the baby is from Bethlehem. Why would he?
Well, there's a lot of questions.
Yeah.
To begin with, one obvious source of confusion: the day that is traditionally associated with the arrival of the three wise men in Bethlehem is Epiphany, which is the 6th of January.
Oh.
So
Herod's done the slaughtering before he's even...
Yeah, so there's some confusion there.
Yeah.
But also, nobody else... You know, if this happened, nobody else mentions it. So none of the other three gospel writers... So Josephus, who writes an awful lot about Herod, Jewish historian of the 1st century AD, he doesn't mention it either. So the likelihood that this is historical is fairly minimal. And so you may wonder, well, you know, where does the story originate?
What's going on?
Well, okay, so I think two things are going on here. The first is, I mean, you may remember in the episode we did on Muhammad, we talked about how historically implausible quite a lot of the events that are traditionally associated with the life of Muhammad are. And quite a lot of those, you know, they're historical implausibilities, but they're not theological implausibilities. So there's a kind of sacred history that gets written that doesn't necessarily obey the dictates of history as someone doing their A-level, say, might understand it. And an awful lot about the life of Muhammad is modelled on the life of Moses. And I think the same thing is happening here, because Jesus is going to Egypt in this case, but Moses leads the children of Israel out of Egypt. Yeah. And the climactic plague... You know, Pharaoh resists allowing the children of Israel to leave. He gets hit by 10 plagues. The climactic plague is the death of the firstborn.
Oh, so that's very similar, isn't it, basically?
So there are kind of echoes. I mean, it's literally kind of mirror image of what happens in Exodus with this. It's kind of establishing the link between Jesus and Moses. It's this idea that what happened in what Christians call the Old Testament is now being kind of echoed in the New Testament. What is the role that Herod is playing in this? Well, the thing that Herod is notorious for is that he kills his own children.
Oh,
so he's He has a large number of wives. He's very, very suspicious. So that idea that Herod would not be happy to learn that there was a rival potential king of the Jews is absolutely true to his character. He's very happy to kill his own children if he feels that they're a dynastic threat. So much so that the Emperor Augustus, it is said, made the very amusing quip that he would rather be Herod's pig than his child.
Right.
You know, which is a good joke.
Okay.
It's recorded by Macrobius, who's writing much later, kind of 4th-5th century. But it's a good joke. And so I think that's kind of what's happening there.
So hold on. The Gospel of Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
We could go down a massive rabbit hole here, but is it genuinely written by somebody called Matthew, first of all?
Probably not, no.
Okay. So who's writing it?
I think we should do an episode on the historical Jesus and the Gospels. I mean, it's an incredible, you can imagine. I mean,
but why would really they have it in for Herod particularly?
Because Herod is the dominant figure in, well, let's not call it Jewish, let's call it Judean historical memory. And Matthew is writing his Gospel against the backdrop of the Judean revolt, which we're going to do an episode about in the new year. And that obviously sees the destruction of the temple, which had been built by Herod. It sees the storming of Masada, which had been built by Herod. It sees the Judean revolt break out in the great port city of Caesarea, which had been built by Herod. Basically, Herod builds everything. Mm-hmm. He's a massive man for the grand projet. And the issues that kind of explode in the Judean revolt, a lot of them can be traced back to the figure of Herod. And Herod has been described as one of the few historical figures who's equally loathed by Jews and Christians.
But Herod is not originally Jewish himself, is he? He's Nabataean Arab, is that right? He's
Well, he claims to be Jewish.
But he converts, doesn't he, to Judaism? Yeah, he's not from a Jewish family.
But the Judean Jewish identity is a much more fluid, much more complicated thing than it subsequently becomes.
Right.
So he's a kind of ambivalent figure, and obviously he's held up by the gospel writer as a contrast to Christ, who will never be a king in the conventional sense, who will go to the cross. And that is the contrast. And, you know, the echoes of the death and suffering that surround his birth is also there in the frankincense and the myrrh. Right. That the wise men bring.
Do you know what I'm going to say about Herod? I think Herod's got a very bad press because actually, if you look at Herod's times, Herod moves horses very skillfully, doesn't he? So he's originally in with Mark Antony and then Cleopatra, and then he switches to Octavian.
Well, Octavian summons him and says, well, you know, what do you say? Why have you been backing Mark Antony? And he says, well, I was a good friend to Mark Antony and now I will be a good friend to you.
Yeah, it's good.
And Octavian says, yeah, fair enough.
It's very Succession.
Very Succession.
He's the Tom Wamsgams.
He is.
Middle Eastern politics. Yeah, he's a bit of a parvenu, but he outsmarts
outlives
the people.
Cleopatra, outlives Antony. Yeah. No, so he's very, and I think that he has to be brutal to be successful.
But he has this very unfortunate end, doesn't he, Herod? Isn't he eaten by worms or something like that?
His son, Herod Agrippa, but he dies horribly as well.
I was just reading up on it. He dies, a thing called of Herod's curse or Herod's
scratching his skin off.
Yeah, Herod's evil. Yeah. He dies of an illness called. I mean, having an illness named after you, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah. So not good. But this becomes for the church. It becomes one of the great festivals. The innocents are accounted the first Christian martyrs. So even ahead of Saint Stephen, whose martyrdom is on Boxing Day, 26th of December. And it inspires the famous Coventry Carol in the 14th century. La, 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 thou little tiny child. No, I can't do it.
That was brilliant, Tom. That was just a taste. Maybe if you join the Rest is History Club, it's not too late to join the Rest is History Club, be able to hear Tom singing the whole thing.
Herod the king, in his raging, charged he hath this day his men of might, in his own sight, all young children to slay. You'll know it if you hear it. And, you know, very movingly, that was sung on Childermas. So this day in 1940 in the smoking ruins of Coventry Cathedral.
That is moving.
It is moving, isn't it?
Yeah. I know you're a big fan of Coventry Cathedral, aren't you? And
yes, wonderful.
The city of Coventry generally.
Wonderful. Yeah. I visited the rebuilt cathedral the first time this year. I It's the greatest modern British building.
Wow.
That's amazing place. Amazing place. But also, Dominic, this sets up a future episode we're going to have. We're going to talk about Camus, Albert Camus.
Yeah.
And he wrote La Chute, The Fall.
Yeah.
In which he, Christ allows himself to be crucified out of the guilt that he feels at not having been one of the innocents.
Oh, that's not very nice. That's not very Christmassy, Tom.
It's incredibly Christmassy.
That's more Eastery, I think, Christ's crucifixion, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's doing it because of something that happened at Christmas.
I know, but I mean, we don't want to be talking about guilt. And I mean, that's what guilt, that's what, victimhood, that's the stuff of academic history. We don't do that kind of thing,
no,
Tom.
It's the stuff of Christmas.
Okay, well, listen, I have a brilliant yeah, anniversary for the second half. So if you're feeling a bit low thinking about the Massacre of the Innocents, cheer up, because coming after the break is the Tay Bridge disaster and the greatest poem in history.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to this special 12 Days of Christmas episode. We are talking the events of the 28th of December. We've already done Childermas, the Massacre of the Innocents, and now we've got more death and destruction, but we've also got poetry.
Yeah.
And Dominic, we love a poem on this podcast.
We do.
We've read a lot of poetry on it, but I think...
You'll never get a better poem than this one. Now, I'm going to build up to the poem because I don't want to go in on the poem. I'll go in on the death. So there is a bridge in Scotland called the Tay Rail Bridge. And this is built in June 1878. And it goes across the Firth of Tay to Dundee. So it's a great age of engineering, of kind of engineering and architectural marvels in Victorian Britain. And this is one of them. It runs for about 2 miles, this bridge, this rail bridge. It's kind of a symbol of modernity and of progress and so on. The architect is a man called Thomas Bouch, or Bauch, I think Bouch. And now the building work, this is not unfamiliar with, you're talking about Grand Projet in the first half, Herod's Grand Projet. This is a Victorian Grand Projet that has gone massively over budget, as Grand Projet tend to.
So it's kind of HS2.
It is HS2. So costs have been cut during the building. And the architect, Mr. Bouch, has made absolutely no allowance whatsoever for high winds.
Oh, no.
Which is very foolish with a Scottish rail bridge. So let's fast forward by 18 months or so from when it was built. And we are on the evening of the 28th of December, 1879. So you can picture the scene. Kind of dark night, The winds howling, the rain lashing down, very Scottish kind of winter weather. The Edinburgh Express is travelling from Burnt Island. And at seven, just after 7 o'clock, it heads towards the Tay Rail Bridge, goes onto the bridge. At 7:13 p.m., it's given the signal to go ahead to kind of continue its journey. And it has five carriages and it has a luggage van. And it's halfway across the bridge, Tom. It's halfway there. And suddenly there is this great flash of light that illuminates the sky. And then total darkness.
What was the flash?
I don't know. I think probably was lightning. Yeah, it probably was in the middle of the storm. Lightning, but also maybe something going wrong. I don't know. Sparks or who knows. The train doesn't blow up. But basically, the bridge collapses with the train on it. So within moments, the bridge, the girders, the train, all the people... into the Tay, into the Firth of Tay, and everybody dies. Mm. Now, no one's quite sure exactly how many people are on the train. Probably about 75 people, including all the staff.
Yeah.
There are no survivors at all. Now, the terrible thing for Mr. Bouch, he's no longer Mr. Bouch, he's Sir Thomas. He's been knighted for the bridge, would you believe? Scottish Bridge Building. And less than a year later, he dies of shock and distress of mind. So
that's him credit.
So it's a very sad story. All these people killed on this bridge. Now, that's not really why people remember this, because this story, this very sad moment, comes to the attention of a man called William McGonagall, the inspiration for Harry Potter's Professor McGonagall in the name, famous as the worst poet in recorded history. So William McGonagall is a kind of interesting man. His family is probably Irish. And they've been moving around in Victorian Britain to find work. And William was a handloom weaver. So he's got no education.
But he loved Shakespeare, didn't he?
He did love Shakespeare.
Do you have an amusing story to tell us about him playing Macbeth?
How do you know? You've obviously been doing the same research as me in the Bodleian Library.
I actually looked this up for our Macbeth episode and I forgot to mention it.
When he was working at his loom, William McGonagall would... it says entertain, but I think probably annoy his fellow workers by reciting bits of Shakespeare because he's a great autodidact. So
that's what you want, isn't it, with a fellow worker?
Of course.
Shakespeare's soliloquies. Yeah,
exactly. So at one point, the other workers pay a local theatre owner to allow him to appear in the title role in a production of Macbeth. This is maybe their way of trying to get rid of him. I don't know.
But
McGonagall gets into his head that the guy who's playing Macduff is jealous of him, and to get his revenge he refuses to die in the final act, so this guy's trying to kill him and he just won't die. So that's the sign of a great literary craftsman, I think, and a great showman. And in 1877, when McGonagall is probably about 50, he has this almost religious
the muse
conversion.
Comes on him, doesn't it?
It does. Do you want me to read you what he says? I seem to feel, as it were, a strange kind of feeling stealing over me, and I remained so for about 5 minutes. A flame, as Lord Byron has said, kindled up my entire frame, along with a strong desire to write poetry. And I felt so happy that I was inclined to dance. Then I began to pace backwards and forwards in the room, trying to shake off all thought of writing poetry. But the more I tried, the more strong the sensation became. It was so strong I imagined a pen was in my right hand, and a voice crying, "Write! Write!" I mean, Tom, did you have this when you first came to you to write history?
Well, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night wondering whether the words will ever come.
Well, that problem did not afflict William McGonagall.
No, it did
he
not.
He could never have advertised BetterHelp. So a year later, he walks from Dundee. It's just such a funny story. He walks from Dundee to Balmoral. So that's about 60 miles. He walks over through the mountains.
To offer his services to the Queen, right?
Through a violent thunderstorm. To offer his services. And when he arrives at Balmoral, he announces himself to the guards. He says, "I am the Queen's poet." And the guards say to him, "You're not the Queen's poet. Tennyson is the Queen's poet." So McGonagall is outraged. And the reason is because he had written to the Queen to tell her that he wanted to become her poet. And he'd taken up poetry. And some flunky in the royal household had sent back a form letter saying,
"The Queen Victoria, is very grateful for your communication.
And will follow your career with interest." And he was like, "Great, I'm on my way." he's not deterred by this. And so 2 years after this incident at Balmoral, he decides he's going to write about the Tay Bridge disaster. And this is the poem that I think people agree is his masterpiece, the single worst poem, because he's a terrible, terrible poet. So it's very long, so I'm just going to read the beginning and the end. So it's called The Tay Bridge Disaster, 1880. Here's how it begins. "Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. Oh, ill-fated bridge of the silvery Tay, I now must conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly without the least dismay that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side by buttresses, at least many sensible men confesses. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed."
That's great. But the moment you hear buttresses,
I think buttresses,
you're a dog to know what he's going to rhyme with that.
Confesses. Do you think that's a good rhyme? Buttresses, confesses? I don't think that's a great rhyme.
No, yeah. Well, it's...
I think that to me, Tom, the problem there is which will be remembered for a very long time.
Yeah.
I think that's quite a pathetic end to that first verse.
Are you seriously engaging in practical criticism?
Yeah, of William McGonagall's poetry.
Well, he was very good at prose as well.
Was he? Do you have
my
an
dear
example?
Readers of this autobiography, which I am the author of, began his author. But Dominic, do you know did you read about how he tried to make money working in a circus?
I didn't actually. Would you like to tell me about that?
He wasn't invited to literary festivals.
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't. So he was reduced to working in a circus, at which he would read his poetry. And the audience was invited to pelt him with eggs, flour, and other comestibles.
They were invited, so they were told to bring them beforehand.
Yeah. Got it. Like being on a podcast.
Yeah. I hope that doesn't happen to us when we do like the Rust is History.
I know. It's terrible.
Live.
Big terrible.
Pelt us with eggs. That'd be very depressing.
But it's, I mean, a kind of tragic figure.
Definitely a tragic figure. You know, a very sort of, because he's not that classic thing of somebody who's completely unaware of his reputation.
Yeah,
I think because the thing with the reason the Tay Bridge poem is remembered is because the incongruity of the tragedy of the subject and the ridiculousness of the handling. The absolute insensitivity. Anyway, that concludes. I've got nothing left to say about William McGonagall or the Tay Rail Bridge.
Well, I think you've done it justice.
Good. I didn't do it in a Scottish accent.
There was a hint. There was a ghostly hint of a Scottish accent, giving the world a glimpse of what your Macbeth might have been.
That's right. Not to say my Paddington. Right. I'm not definitely not in an accent in the next episode because I will be cancelled.
What are we doing for the next episode? Remind me.
Well, we're doing another of my theatrical performances because you're doing Thomas Beckett, aren't you?
Yes.
Haven't you chosen to do Thomas Beckett?
Yes.
And I'm doing The Massacre at Wounded Knee.
No,
so I don't think I should
do
any voices for
that. No, don't right. do that. All right.
See you tomorrow.
We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.